Heat pumps seem to be having a moment. If you've been wondering about how you might heat, or for that matter, cool your home during the winter and summer months, you've probably been hearing about them. They are widely viewed as one of the alternatives to heating systems that depend on fossil fuels, like oil or propane gas, as ways to reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere, as concerns about climate change and state targets for reducing those emissions begin to bite and come closer. So what are heat pumps exactly, and how do they work? For more on that, we turn to Steve Spatz, a supply chain account manager with Efficiency Vermont, the state's energy efficiency utility, to learn more.
Heat pump technology has been around for a very, very long time. Refrigerants are gases that can exist both as a liquid and a solid, and depending on the state that they're in, they're able to absorb heat energy from the ambient air from which they're contained. So that's what makes them unique materials or unique gases, elements that we can use to move heat energy. That's the key difference of a heat pump versus a fossil fuel fired system or a combustion piece of equipment. Maybe is a better way to put it. Combustion equipment, where you're burning a fuel, whether that's propane, oil, wood, coal, whatever you're burning, you're relying on the breakdown and of the material itself, and the fuel, and the release of carbon to release heat energy. It's released in the material by way of combustion. Refrigeration, that process is a matter, again, of moving a gas, typically, that is able to absorb heat energy from the ambient environment that it's contained in. And in the context of a heat pump for heating and cooling our homes, that's a copper pipe, a thin, you know, diameter copper pipe. And by moving that gas through a continuous loop of piping in the environment that you're trying to extract heat energy from, the gas within that pipe is able to absorb heat energy, move it to a different place where heat exchange occurs, where it transfers from a gas to a liquid and the heat energy is released. And then that heat energy is then used to either heat a space or conversely, in the cooling environment, reject heat and move heat to a different place. So it's a transfer of heat energy versus a creation of heat energy when it comes to how we're using them for supplementing and or replacing combustion equipment here in the Northeast.
To see an actual heat pump in action, we traveled down to North Bennington, where we met up with Bill Morrissey of Weatherization Works, a Paulett-based energy efficiency firm that includes installing heat pumps as part of its lineup of services.
Andrew, I like that this is a good example of a ground-mounted unit. So this whole system sits on a ground mount that is the feet are independently adjustable, so they can be over time. If this unit for some reason becomes out of level, you can independently level it, because it's a good idea that the outdoor units stay relatively level during the heating season. Ice will form on the coil, and it needs to get away from the outdoor unit, so water will flow out of this from time to time, and that would happen during a defrosting cycle. There is always going to be there'll be an outdoor component and an indoor component. So the outdoor, depending on what it's doing, it's either cooling inside or it's heating inside, and that will determine the flow of refrigerant. The beauty of these outdoor units, or cold climate heat pumps, I should say, is that you can flow refrigerant in both directions. So they will heat and they will cool.
All right, so here we have another one.
Yeah.
Would a building normally this size have two heat pumps units, or?
Oh yeah, you could see, we've been on projects with as many as 8 outdoor units. This is a 1-to-1, so it's one outdoor unit paired with one indoor head, but you could easily have an outdoor unit, a multi-zone that would run multiple indoor heads. So you could have one location, an outdoor unit, and then feeding off that several indoor units. Comes down to the square footage of the space, and then sizing it appropriately, because you could You could undersize them, certainly, and then oversize it. So it's important to get it professionally evaluated. This particular unit has a quite a high seasonal energy factor, or seasonal heating factor, of 12.5, so 13.5 at the top of the list. So this particular unit, the Samsung, really really shines nicely in the heating season. So
I was wondering, for houses that already have a heating system, whether oil or wood or coal or whatever, does it make sense to install a heat pump system on top of that and sort of keep the legacy system as a sort of a backup? What's the smart way of going about it? Or is the heat pump the backup?
Yeah, all these systems have a performance curve. So as your temperatures are dipping below zero, they're going to run through more of these defrost cycles. It's a process to protect the outdoor unit, and they're not going to be heating during that time. So the efficiencies are not as wonderful. So say below zero, it's always nice to have another heating system. And I happen to heat with some wood at my own home and love it. But there'll be a time when I'm not going to be so happy about carrying wood and stacking it and splitting it. But right now it works really well. And these systems will go down to super cold conditions. It will run down to a negative 13. The Fujitsus are even colder, work in even colder conditions. So yes, having a separate or independent system is always a good idea.
Buying and installing a heat pump system is not inexpensive, but there are several incentives, like tax credits, available to help soften the upfront cost. And over time, they are likely to pay for themselves and free their owners from worries about the volatility of oil and gas prices.
So the rebate, there's point of sale discounts available on the equipment. So pretty much any heat pump technology has some level of point of sale incentive available for it. And that is money that is supported both through Efficiency Vermont and the utilities within where the customer is living that they're purchasing the heat pump for. And then on top of that, there are other factors that come into play through other initiatives. Like currently the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed by the federal government offers some new tax credits for heat pump equipment that had been previously sunsetted and are now going to be available again starting this year. There are some programs on the horizon which are not established yet, and the details of those are not fully committed and probably won't be until at least late this year, of other cash incentive rebate offers for heat pump equipment that would be coming from the federal government that would add on to or supplement what we already have available here in Vermont.
For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. It already seems like a long time ago, when back in May of 2020, as the COVID pandemic was tearing through Vermont and the rest of the nation, the Vermont National Guard and the Vermont Food Bank, a nonprofit corporation that provides food to those in need through a network of about 300 community partners, were distributing needed food to thousands of area residents who converged on Bromley Mountain's parking lot. The pandemic had forced businesses to close, throwing people out of work, and uncertainty reigned. And at community food distribution sites, like the Manchester Community Food Cupboard, the cars were lined up, their occupants lining up for food, many no doubt wondering what the future held. That was then. Now, about 2.5 years later, the picture looks different. While the pandemic is hardly over, the scenes from Bromley are no longer in the headlines. But are the needs still there? And are the food banks still staying busy? To find out, we stopped by the Manchester Food Cupboard recently to check in, which is where we met up with Martha Carey, the director of the Food Cupboard. Things are just as busy now as they were back then, she told us.
I think we're busier now than we were then. There's a lot less help available now than there was then. A lot of programs have ended. Like, there was some extra child tax credit money, extra unemployment money, other checks from the government, and that all stopped. And now the prices of things are a lot higher. So yeah, we're busier now than we've ever been. We are open 3 days a week. We're open Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We are open to anyone in Vermont. Most of our people come from the very immediate area. But then we get people, you know, people who work in town, people whose kids go to school here in town. Sometimes people come, you know, on the bus, because the bus stop is right outside. The majority are people, you know, from right here within like a 10-mile radius. And then I would say maybe another 20% of the people who come are from towns further afield.
John Sales is the executive director of the Vermont Food Bank and someone we spoke with back in the spring of 2020. From the statewide perspective, he confirmed that the needs for food assistance hadn't changed, citing inflationary pressures and the ending of some of the federal and state supports that had helped people navigate through the worst phases of the pandemic.
It did get a little better after that initial, really crisis, you know, and people were scared. People were scared. And, you know, we, as you were mentioning earlier, we had the lines at the airports and other places, the National Guard helping distribute farmers to families, food boxes, food that, you know, came in from the federal government. Things got a little better after that. But since inflation kind of took hold, things have actually gotten worse. And the latest numbers we have, and this is a UVM team, NFACT, and I can send you the link to their data, that 2 in 5 Vermonters have experienced food insecurity or hunger in the last year. And we're seeing this trend across the country, that things got a little bit better. When there was a lot of assistance there, you know, there was rental assistance, there were the stimulus payments, there was extra food, extra SNAP benefit, and, you know, housing assistance. A lot of that has gone away. In fact, the boost in SNAP benefits, which here is Three Squares Vermont, is going to end at the end of March. And so all those supports have dwindled and are going to be going away. And people have not bounced back from this economically. And we're seeing a sustained increase in folks coming to our network partners. In fact, we just did a survey not too long ago. 60% of the food banks, you know, over 200 food shelf and meal site partners have seen increases, and some of them, the increases are about 20 to 50%, the number of people coming in. And at our Veggie Van Goes, we've seen record numbers, and we're staying at those high numbers right now. So things don't feel like they're getting better.
How do we kind of sort of solve this on a more long-term basis?
Yeah, it really is kind of a macroeconomic issue. One of the things I think has happened is that hunger has come out of the shadows a little bit. I think that what happened during COVID actually reduced the stigma a little bit. And particularly for programs like our Veggie Van Go, which is a drive-through, no questions asked food distribution. Which we do it in, there's 16 of them around this day. We do them in all counties. And, you know, I think people were struggling quietly before COVID. And now people are seeing what can happen when there's help there, right? Because we saw it. The help was there. There was, you know, millions of pounds of federal food that came in. There were stimulus payments. There was rental assistance. There was, you know, housing assistance for people who are unhoused. And we saw things get better. The child tax credit reduced child poverty immediately by 40%. And the follow-up studies show that most families spend some of that money on food. And so people got a glimpse of what it's like when there's help. And as those resources dwindled, wages are up, but wages are not up as much as costs, particularly housing, fuel, and food. You know, gas prices have come down a little bit, but they're not where they were pre-pandemic. And housing costs have skyrocketed, and they're not coming down, right? And food costs, again, I just read in the paper this morning that food costs are up almost 12% over this month last year. You know, eggs are up 100% because of avian flu. So there's a lot of things going on, and the families who, you know, maybe living paycheck to paycheck, maybe not, maybe just having a hard month this month because of something, you know, car repair or fill the oil tank or, you know, pay a medical bill, are reaching out more for help. And it's just more visible than it was. But I think that this level of need has really always been there.
Lindsay Hardy works with the Vermont Food Bank as part of its philanthropic food-raising operation. She noted that Bennington County was one of the areas in the state the food bank has identified as being most in need of food services.
I guess taking just a quick step back and to kind of explain that when we got the extraordinary gift from Mackenzie Scott of the $9 million, a good portion of that money just sort of rolled into our increased operations to help meet the sort of COVID pandemic need. But there was a portion of those funds that was set aside for additive work that we were calling our priority initiatives. And those two initiatives fall into two sort of buckets or lanes. One is called community-driven initiatives, and the other is our Food Security Innovation Lab. And the geographic communities that the Deep Communities work is focusing on are Bennington, Addison County, and the Northeast Kingdom. And while I can't speak to like current numbers of food insecurity on the county level, we do know that Bennington County, along with Addison and Northeast Kingdom, have historically been underserved by our programs and services and have increased incidence of poverty and food insecurity compared to, you know, the rest of the state. So that's sort of the basis for why we chose those communities. The work in Bennington is underway. Over the course of the summer, we hired a woman to be a grassroots organizer, and she spent a lot of time volunteering at local food shelves and food access points throughout Bennington and started to make relationships with people that worked there and also people that use the services, the shoppers. And during November and December, and I got to participate in one series, Ashley, the woman in Bennington, held a bunch of focus groups with folks with lived experience and sort of gleaning their ideas around some of the barriers that they face, some of the issues that they're dealing with, not just in terms of, you know, how to access food, but just in their lives sometimes too. And those conversations have more or less wrapped up, and they're taking place similarly in Addison County and the Northeast Kingdom. And that's going to sort of drive how we respond to sort of shaping some of our programs to better serve the needs of the folks.
It may be that one of the lessons learned from the pandemic is that helping people with their basic needs for food, along with housing, is an ongoing challenge, one that won't be disappearing just because the COVID case counts are falling into more of an endemic state as opposed to a pandemic one. It's clear there will be a role to play for organizations like the Vermont Food Bank and the Manchester Food Cupboard going forward. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. One of the many consequences of the COVID pandemic was the rapid spike in property and real estate prices that occurred in southern Vermont and in many other parts of the state over the last couple of years. Homes that had been selling in one basic bracket suddenly jumped up several notches as interest mounted and people wanted to move to places like Vermont, widely viewed as safer locations from the COVID virus than more urban areas were. Nearly 3 years after the start of the pandemic, that has eased off considerably. But real estate prices still haven't declined much, and a new normal is in place, at least for now. That has also had the effect of throwing out of whack many town grand lists and appraised property values. That matters because the appraised property values are connected to tax rates towns and especially school districts have to levy. School district taxes are highly influenced by what's known as the Common Level of Appraisal, or CLA, which is sort of a ratio between fair market values, what a property is actually selling for, and what its appraised value is on the town's grand list. It's also a method of ensuring that each town is paying its fair share of education property tax to the state's education fund. A CLA of 100% is the gold standard. That means the two values are in lockstep. When the CLA falls below 100%, pressure grows for a reappraisal to keep the two numbers, the appraised value and the value a home is actually selling for, roughly in line with each other. And reappraisals cost money. And there's another problem. There aren't enough qualified and certified reappraisers in the state to conduct them quickly. So to help us untangle what's going on, we talk with Jill Remick, the director of the Division of Property Valuation and Review, which is part of the state's tax department. The Property Valuation and Review Division evaluates a planned reappraisal to determine whether or not the town's plan will meet the goal of coming into compliance with a common level of appraisal. So
there were a lot of sort of outdated or, you know, rusty grand lists even before COVID, right? Because we don't have this requirement for them to be refreshed every number of years. Towns get an annual appropriation of money that they should be setting aside to do reappraisals. So they should kind of have some money set aside for that. But what happened this year that makes it hopefully a little bit more palatable to folks who are concerned about the CLA is sort of, instead of a rising tide lifting all ships, a sinking tide lowered all ships. So the statewide CLA drops significantly just overall. So everyone is kind of in that same boat. If you're a town where your CLA is really out of whack, then you are feeling that effect on your tax rate. But because everybody's CLA has dropped and the yield looks projected to be pretty healthy, it won't necessarily translate into some massive tax increase. Right, the CLA is one component, and the Ed Fund only needs to earn what the Ed Fund needs to earn. So not to minimize in any way, but basically because the whole statewide CLA, because of this COVID market, has dropped, everyone's kind of in the same boat and has the same share of revenue that they need to raise for the Ed Fund. Right now, we're getting contracts from towns. So the towns submit their contract to us for approval if they're under order. And there are some that are waiting and that are basically having to wait until 2027 to start their reappraisal because the few firms we have in Vermont are so backed up. One of the really big challenges this has exacerbated, which again was in place before COVID but now is really obvious, is that we don't have enough appraisers to do this work in Vermont. It's not really a career path that's really clear for folks, right? There's not like a degree you get in appraisal or a track you can do at a career center or something that's appraisal. So especially in Vermont, it's almost like a family business. Like if your parents did it, you're more inclined to be aware of it and get into it. And also we think that the lack of that consistent cycle has made it a little harder for contractors to kind of get their foot in the door and feel safe coming to Vermont to put their sign out to do this for Vermont towns. I'm happy to say we have gotten a lot of interest in the last couple weeks from folks just asking how would I go about becoming an appraiser. And there's two paths. There's a certification that we do at the tax department for municipal appraisal. And then of course at the Secretary of State's office for for real estate and bank appraisals, there's a license that folks can get. So we love the idea of sort of getting the word out because it's an interesting job if people are interested in data and real estate. There's a lot of work in Vermont right now, and it'll only continue to be so. The other piece is we really need to think about how we can share services a little bit more. You know, each and every of the 251 towns trying to find a contractor to do their work, especially in some of these smaller towns, the contractor's not going to bother they have plenty of work to go around, so they'll take a larger town with more parcels because that's typically what the payment is based on. So we're also trying to encourage these towns to kind of join together. So rather than a 500 parcel town where no one's even responding to their request for proposals, if a few of those 500 parcel towns join together, the contractor might be more inclined to sign on and do that reappraisal together, which they absolutely could do. Practically speaking, I think when these statutes were first written, a town could find someone within a year, and then there are definitely penalties, right? We can withhold their funds if they don't carry out their reappraisal. We do not do that now, and we don't plan to do that now, as long as each year the town at least updates us on their plan. Then they'll continue to have their CLA get calculated under the study while they're waiting. The year the reappraisal is complete, then we'll have new values in the CLA sort of resets to 100. But so they'll sort of be in a holding pattern. There's a lot of things towns can do to get ready for their reappraisal. You know, a lot of data cleanup, parcel maintenance in their system, reviewing permits, things like that. Like, there are some things towns can kind of do while they're waiting for their firm to come on board. But we're not imposing any penalty as long as they're just letting us know they're in line with a contractor.
We followed up that conversation with three other local officials to get a sense of what's happening in our region. Gordon Black is the town assessor for Manchester.
I think one of the things that happens is that towns try to avoid a townwide reappraisal. In a perfect world, you would do these every 4 or 5 years. Manchester, as an example, has not done an official townwide reappraisal since about 2005. So it's been a long time. Now, there's been a little bit of statistical adjustment along the way. I think condominiums at one point got adjusted downward to try to reflect the market. But the reality is Manchester, like a lot of these towns, have just not done these reappraisals because they're very expensive. The one for Manchester, as an example, is about $250,000. Now, we got lucky and scheduled our reappraisal before the whole COVID process. And we actually delayed it because of COVID. And our timing ended up being pretty much perfect because our reappraisal will be completed this spring. So we're going to avoid the CLA problem that all these other towns have had. I mean, I don't know if you looked at the numbers, Andrew, but as an example, Dorset's CLA is down to 81.14. And there's something called a coefficient of dispersion also, which, you know, you could have an average that's 100 and still have wide ranges. You know, some like big properties are underassessed and smaller properties are overassessed, but the average could still be good. So they look at not only the CLA, the common level of appraisal, but they look at this other factor too, this coefficient of dispersion. Dorset's was over 20. That's automatically a mandatory reappraisal. North Bennington, their CLA went down to 69.47, which is outrageously out of whack. They had a coefficient of dispersion over 20. Shaftesbury, 84. COD over 20. Sunderland, 81. And the coefficient of dispersion in Sunderland is 33.45, which is the largest COD I've ever seen in my experience. So that just means that they're way out of whack. Some properties are over, some properties are under. I think the big problem has been the increase in value. It's not so much fluctuations as much as the demand for Vermont properties just increased dramatically, and people were paying top dollar just to have a place in Vermont. Now, the other thing is we do have to put a value on all properties as of April 1 of 2023. That's going to be our requirement. However, when the state calculates the common level of appraisal, they use the last 3 years of sales data. And so when you take the average over a 3-year period, that's going to be pretty high. We can't just say we think it's going to go down. We have to have our reappraisal numbers match up with this three-year average. That's how they calculate the CLA. So a lot of people have asked me or have stated that they believe that the market's going down, or they hope that it's going down, or they expect it's going to go down. But I still have an obligation to match our numbers with this three-year average in order to get our CLA at a good number. Now, the reappraisal should put us right in that 97 to 100% range. It's never going to be perfectly 100%, but if we're in that 97% or above range, we're in good shape.
Doug Poulter is a lister in Win Hall.
CLA for the town of Win Hall dropped from 98% to 78% in 12 months. Now, the way the state statistically analyzes sales relative to the town's assessment of properties, it is a three-year period of time. So the probably two of the 3 years in this average includes the pandemic years, if you will. But it happened very rapidly, and although not unexpectedly, because we saw the sales, we knew what the purchase prices were as the sales rolled in. So in Win Hall, we proactively attempted to obtain a contract for a townwide reappraisal with one of the companies or individuals that specialize in those services. We put out an RFP in spring of 2022. There were no responses. The town administrator sent individual notices to all of the 20 some odd, and I don't know exactly how many there are on the list, but the state of Vermont has a list of approved appraisals, appraisers and appraisal companies. Contacted each one of those separately, individually, still had no responses, and then got on the phone and started talking to individuals at companies directly. And we were able to, find some reputable company that would extend to us a contract. Contract is signed and was finished, that process was finished in November of 2022. So we actually have a contract for a townwide reappraisal, and that contract was negotiated prior to the state's release of the data for the 2023 CLA. So in that regard, we're in good shape, other than the fact that the waiting list for this company to get around to Win Hall, for our turn in the queue, is probably 24 months out, or perhaps even longer.
And finally, we spoke with Nick Zayas, the town administrator for Arlington.
Yeah, Arlington had a reappraisal last year, and like many communities in the state, we saw our common level of appraisal study come back on the low end of the spectrum. In our case, it came in at about 87% of the state average of CLA, which does not trigger an automatic reappraisal like many towns are, but that will have a substantial impact on tax rates, both for the town budget and the school budget. The inability of that study and that reappraisal to appropriately capture the increase in property taxes in housing values in our community will make it so nameplate prices and nameplate tax rates will have to rise in accordance with the underassessment. So the story like a town like Dorset has encountered, where their assessments properly did keep up with where inflation and housing prices really are right now, is not the case here, where we're seeing greater than expected tax increases, not because of a very high increase in spending, but because the assessments did not rise in, like many other towns did, to cause rates to actually drop or stabilize at higher spending levels.
So the downside then to having, you know, a CLA or appraised value being lower than fair market value, what's the problem with that?
It can really weigh on the ability of governments to finance their operations when faced with inflationary pressures that also cross over in the housing market. If people are experiencing housing prices that are going up and are paying higher housing prices in our communities, and those housing prices are not properly reflected in the grand list, that means that the total pile of assessed value of the community, typically our town sits right in the $320 million of total assessed value range, will not be able to support the spending that is going up with inflation that crosses over in this space. So you're getting something that's being felt by the people but not translating into the property tax base. And that means that the town services get relatively more expensive compared to everything else that taxpayers are paying for. So it can make the cost of government feel greater than it is, but simply because we are not appropriately accounting for the housing prices that people are actually paying in the real world. So, well, I'll caveat that I am not a Vermont property tax expert. The general mechanism is that while the government is not getting disproportionately more expensive, people will feel like the government is getting disproportionately more expensive because they've already been paying the higher housing rates that have not been felt in the grand list and been properly socialized out across everyone to make sure that the tax rates are being appropriately shared by the community and are keeping up with the needs of level funding our government services at worst.
Given the shortage of qualified appraisers, it may be a while before towns get their appraisal values up to date. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Sunday, January 29th, a scrimmage was held in Bennington at the former high school building, but it wasn't one involving two sports teams practicing for the big game. Rather, it was two tech clubs, the Manchester Machine Makers and the Bennington area Cookie Clickers, first tech robotics teams meeting up to share ideas and to demonstrate the robots they've designed for a statewide competition, which will be held on February 11th up at Champlain Valley High School in Hinesburg. The competition is being sponsored by the University of Vermont's College of Engineering. 19 teams, all told, will be taking part to see how well their machines perform with executing certain tasks, like picking up paper cones and putting them on poles, this year's challenge. Each team had their own approach. The scrimmage began with each team discussing how they built their machines and the challenges they overcame, with the Cookie Clickers going first.
So this is the arm.
Telescoping.
Tell us about how you made it.
Yeah, telescoping arm, it goes up and down.
To grip something, you just have to put it in between these two, and this rack and pinion pinch these down onto it. Yeah,
something like this?
Indeed.
How would it work?
Show us what the cone is.
And then it was the turn of the Manchester Machine Makers.
So for our slide system, we have telephone cables running to the servo on the end with the claw and another running to our sensors. And we were having a similar issue with your return. It wouldn't go all the way down. We had a return cable initially, but the travel distance for that cable and for the extension cables was different, so that would end up snapping throughout the matches. So we just took that off recently. We replaced it with a counterweight to bring it back down, as opposed to elastic, so that it goes down with gravity. These slides use the similar system to yours, where you just pull the pulley, except there's two of them. They run off of the same motor with the sprocket and chain system, and they have four stages each, which gets us up to the high junction.
We caught up with two of the team leaders shortly afterwards for more.
This year, the challenge is we have an array of poles that are on springs and spaced in a grid pattern, and we get points for scoring cones on those poles. And there's also a additional bonus if you score those cones in a rectilinear grid. The most recent cone to be scored on a pole basically claims that pole for your alliance. So you're playing an elaborate game of tic-tac-toe across those poles in an attempt to create a line across that grid.
So what's been the hardest challenge to overcome in the process of building the robots that each one of your teams are doing?
I think the hardest challenge for us is working together to build one robot and like bringing all the different parts in. Some people are good at code and some people are good at design, so just figuring out what works best. Yeah, there's an autonomous mode, which is basically a robot. We have to tell it to do something through code, and it has to do it on its own without a driver. And then there's a part of the competition where you can drive the robot, so we have to code in the functions to the different buttons on the controller and just make sure all the things work with the code.
Like she was saying, a lot of the more complex coding tasks come in that autonomous period. For example, recognizing the image on the cone, which you have to do through a machine learning network that uses TensorFlow. And also location of the robot on the field, which can be done with either navigation targets on each wall using Euphoria or encoders and a PID algorithm to go back and forth onto locations in the field.
And how often does each of your clubs meet? Do you guys meet like every week or every other day?
Meet twice a week. We meet on Tuesdays and Sundays. On Tuesdays for only a couple hours, and then on Sundays sometimes two, sometimes 4 hours.
We also have two sessions each week. Each one is 2 hours, one on Wednesday, one on Sunday.
The Manchester Machine Makers feature team members from the Maple Street School, Burn Burton Academy, and Granville High School. The Cookie Clickers bring together students from the Southshire Community School in North Bennington, Cambridge Central School in Cambridge, New York, Mount Anthony Union Middle School, and the Mount Anthony Union High School, as well as homeschool students. During a break in the action, we had a chance to speak with the coaches of the respective teams.
And so our team spends September to February building a robot to accomplish the tasks that are given in this year's challenge. In previous years, they've shot rings to score goals. And last year, they had to pick up elements and dump them into another bucket. And so it's always a little bit different. But they always have to drive around, and so there are certain commonalities to learning how to engineer a robot.
And the other thing I'd add is we tend to always refer to it as a competition because that's what's going to be easily appreciated by other people. The organization first really is built on this idea of gracious professionalism, and so it's actually within our group referred to as a co-opetition. So in one round, it's a competition between alliances of two teams. In one round, you might be teamed with, we might be teamed up with Manchester Machine Makers. In the next round, we might be competing against them with a different team. And so a lot of this is really about how do we cooperate in order to accomplish something.
And with the competition goes the presentations. So not only do the students need to build the robot, but keeping track of what they're doing, what their ideas are, what their failures were, what their successes were, and then presenting that to the judges at the competition.
Is the purpose of today to kind of troubleshoot or kind of see where some problems may still be?
Yeah, you may call it like a scrimmage, non-competitive, challenging each other's and getting ideas and helping each other improve the robots and the task at hand, whatever that might be.
Also, sort of a dry run for the competition.
And to practice speaking to other people about what they've done.
Yes.
So learning the communication side of science, technology, engineering, and math. and sharing their story and what they've thought of and what they've done. Yeah, so
it is part of the competition as well, presenting themselves and talking about what they did and how they did it and the challenges they faced. It is part of it. They have to do that. Mm-hmm. So. Right.
Yeah, as the competition comes, they have to have their robots on the field performing the tasks, right? But an equal part of the competition itself are judged awards. Each of our teams have done very well in the judged awards. What that is all about is actually the engineering notebook. So any engineering project, right, will have a process that it goes through of trying things, discarding them, refining them. And what we do in the engineering notebook is we document all that. Speaking as a software person, we hate documenting, right? But it's really important. And
the first Tech Challenge will be held on Saturday, February 11th, and will be a chance for these budding tech wizards to show off their coding skills and more before a statewide audience. And then, maybe more. This is an international competition, and the next step would be, maybe, onto the New England Regional Contest in April. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Now drive it around.
Voters in Windhall will be heading back to the Mountain School for their in-person traditional town meeting on Tuesday, March 7th, after a couple of years of meeting at the town's transfer station garage. Once there, they'll get to weigh in on budgets proposed by their school district and municipal government to determine their tax rates and other outcomes laid out in the town and school budgets and reports. On the school side, the tax rate will be decreasing as a result of education spending per pupil dropping by a little over 6%. At the same time, the town's common level of appraisal, a measurement of a property's fair market value compared to its town appraised value, has dropped by nearly 15%, which has an upward impact on the tax rate and eventually results in a tax rate of about $1.58. School Board Chairwoman Jennifer Samuelson explains.
So the good news is our tax rate's going, it's projected to go down this year. So I think our residents should be pretty happy about that. One of the biggest drivers of that is that the property yield has gone up, which actually serves to bring our ultimate equalized tax rate down. So I think that really had a lot to do with why our tax rate's going down. The other thing is the number of pupils that we have in Windhall is lower than what we had anticipated last year when we set our budget. So that's also allowing us to have a little bit of a surplus that we can put into the tax stabilization fund. We're so small that having a few students move away tends to have a outsized impact on our budget. And this year it's a positive change. So we've got a couple of articles also on the warning that may adjust the tax rate, but you know, going into town meeting, we're anticipating a tax rate of just over $1.58. So again, really on the lower side of our historic tax rates. I think one of the things that's going to be really important for our voters to understand is that this year is a gift. I don't know that it's going to continue going forward in future years for a couple of reasons. One is that property yield rate is so high this year. I don't expect that will continue, but you never know. But the other thing that will definitely happen beginning with next fiscal year, we're setting the budget for FY24 and effective FY25, the pupil weights will change. And so Sue Wilburn from the BRSU has done a really good job of calculating out what our tax rate would look like under the new pupil weight system, and it will definitely go up. The other thing is from FY25 to FY29, will be capped at a 5% increase per year. But even if we keep it at $1.58 this year, if you multiply a 5% increase over the next 5 years, at the end of that fifth year, that'll have our tax rate over $2, which is kind of at the higher end of where it's been over the past several years. you know, not quite in the middle, but not as high, not as absolutely high as it's been. But that really does speak to thinking thoughtfully about our budget for FY24, because it will have, you know, these ripple effects for the next several years.
Windhall doesn't operate its own school and has a school choice model that compensates families for sending their children to either the Mountain School Windhall or other neighboring schools through high school. There will be an advisory article in the school district warning asking if voters want to continue supporting this model.
Well, that is something that we are going to be discussing at town meeting. We're in a really good position right now with our tax rate. We do have an advisory article on our warning. It's Article 9, where we're asking folks to come in and vote from the floor to voice their support or not for our current K-12 choice model. In the past, we found that this is something that has worked for us and that our voters have really preferred, but we thought it would be a good inflection point and just capture that sentiment to see, you know, if voters are still supporting the educational choice model that we have.
So
there is a petition that has been warned seeking an increased tuition to the Mountain School. So we received, you know, the requisite number of signatures. We did place that on the article, on the warning. It's Article 4. And I anticipate that representatives from the Mountain School will be able to speak more to this issue at town meeting. But again, it's just really important that people show up on March 7th because we vote from the floor. So if you're not there, your vote won't be heard.
Over on the municipal side, voters will see a budget that calls for about $4.4 million to be raised by taxes, compared to about $3.7 million last year, and the proposed tax rate rising by a little under 10 cents per $100 of assessed property value. Town Administrator Lissa Stark took us inside the proposed town budget. One thing voters will notice is the large difference in the bottom line totals of this year's budget compared to last year, about a $13 million difference. But there's a reason for that, she said.
Which is, it's a proposed roughly 9-cent increase in the tax rate. So we're looking at going to about 60, almost 62 cents. And we were at 52, 53 almost last year. So I'll back up and say that right at the beginning of the revenues, when people get their proposed budget, we are going to include all of the monies that we pay. It's basically pass-through monies that goes to the state for education dollars and to the school district for education dollars. So we're putting those all into the taxes line item. That first thing that you see at the top, it is almost $17 million. That is an actual, you know, figure that we have kind of come up with there. But usually what we do is we net out all the payments that we pass through and we put them in that line. So it basically looks like it's a lot less money. So like last year it was 3.7 million, but we really did take in, you know, 15 or 16 million. So where people will notice the difference is in the very beginning of the expenses under the general expenses, we have broken out that, you know, the state education dollars are roughly 7.7 million that we pass through to the state. And then we pass through roughly 4.8 million to the supervisory union on behalf of the Windhall School District. So those are pretty significant amounts that are now shown more clearly instead of netted out. You know, we're all looking at inflation being ever increasing. So a lot of our numbers had to go up, you know, to compensate for inflation or to account for inflation. We are putting a substantial amount of money into the fire and rescue equipment fund for the new fire truck that we are going to need to purchase very, very soon. So, you know, that expenditure alone is $275,000 and it's usually roughly $60,000. So that's fairly substantial. And also we've been putting more money into the Stratton Access Road Reserve Fund for culvert upgrades and repairs to the access road. So that's another $300,000 expense that is fairly substantial. But for the most part, we're talking about inflationary raises to bring us up that, you know, to that almost 9 cent or roughly 9 cent increase in the tax rate.
And then just moving on to the warning, you have that one article there about hiring a part-time or sharing a rec director with a couple of your neighboring towns. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about that and what's going on with that idea.
This a group of towns have come together. We were approached by, I think, Londonderry to basically propose that we hire together collectively a rec director, recreation director that would, and I'm looking at kind of the scope here as I look down, basically to be in charge of handling administration of some of the recreation facilities and coordinating youth programs and getting the word out about what programs are available and that that type of thing to kind of like help promote recreation in the area. And we, the other, I know that Londonderry is one of the other towns, but there are a number of other towns that are kind of in on this collaborative. So Londonderry, Landgrove, Peru, Weston, and Windhall at this moment are kind of on the list as being some close-knit towns that could probably work together to share this this one rec director position. So that's why the $25,000 is in the on the warning.
Windhall's town meeting will be held on Tuesday, March 7th, and will be starting at 10 a.m. to transact the business in the town warning, which will be done from the floor, as well as through Australian ballot for elected officials and ballot articles. On March 7th, polls will be open from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Any voter unable to come to the polls may request an absentee ballot by contacting the town clerk no later than 1 p.m. on Monday, March 6th. For the GNOW TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.